This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. And while the shows is on the air, in progress, please consider becoming a financial supporter to this radio station by calling 516-620-3602 or go to give2wbai.org. Now stay tuned for Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg coming up.
Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Are the chickens coming home to roost again? Well, it's a new day of infamy, but it's rooted in centuries-old white supremacy.
The far-right siege on the U.S. Capitol has been called unbelievable, shocking, and beyond imagination. But let's not forget the attacks on state houses around the nation and all the symbols hate deployed. Guillotine, hangman's noose, Confederate and Nazi iconography, though they received far less coverage.
The playbook for the MAGA invasion of the nation's Capitol building has been developing for years in plain sight. At far-right rallies, in cities like Charlottesville, Berkeley and Portland, and then in the past year at state capitals across the country, where heavily armed white protesters have forced their way into legislative chambers to accuse politicians of tyranny and treason. While what happened was outrageous and wrong, was it really unbelievable?
The far right's fears about replacement of the white race and outsider invasions, and its anger is routinely stoked by the President of the United States and his cronies. White nationalism is closer to the mainstream of American politics than ever before.
This is a dangerous and scary time, but it's not the first, and it won't be the last eruption of the white supremacist violence we experienced. Let's not get fooled thinking the 25th Amendment, impeachment, prosecutions of insurrectionists and or those in power who incited violence, sedition, will end this. Historians are rightly making connections to the Civil War, including declaring the Confederacy finally stormed the Capitol. But white supremacy goes deeper than the Civil War and predates slavery. It is foundational to the U.S. settler state.
So, instead of being shocked, this time, let's learn our history and let's start showing up for racial justice, against poverty and for economic justice, as internationalists and against militarism, and live that credo and standing firmly against redbaiting.
We're joined now by Eric Ward, Executive Director and Senior Fellow with the Southern Poverty Law Center and Race Forward.
Eric Ward is Executive Director of Western State Center, a national hub for innovative responses to white nationalism and structural inequality. Ward is a nationally recognized expert on the relationship between authoritarian movements, hate violence, and building toward inclusive democracy.
Eric, I'm torn between saying, how do you describe what happened on January 6th and going further back, which is, who were the party that stimulated the events of January 6th? Help us understand who was involved and what you think actually happened with a kind of unity of purpose, apparently, on January 6th.
I think it's important for all of us to understand is that what we are witnessing, not just on January 6th in D.C., but what we are witnessing since then is an insurrection. We're not talking about an attempt to overthrow a policy or to force the resignation of an elected official. What we are talking about is an attempt to put into place an authoritarian leader. And we have to understand that that is what is occurring. Now, on Wednesday, January 6th in Washington, D.C., what the American public witnessed was a configuration of a number of entities, everything from groups like the Three Percenters, Proud Boys, white nationalists, anti-vaxxer, anti-mask movements. It was a configuration of the far right that has largely been centered around a coalition that we in America understand as the alt-right. The alt-right has its roots within the white nationalist movement in this country. The white nationalist movement is a social movement. And similarly to how environmental movements function or the civil rights movement, it is a social movement that does not seek to preserve white supremacy. In fact, it sees white supremacy, a historical system of discrimination, as a failed program. It seeks instead to overthrow the U.S. government in order to establish a government that can proceed in creating an all-white ethnostate, meaning a nation state that is free of Jews and people of color. If white supremacy is about exploitation, white nationalism is about ethnic cleansing, and it understands that it needs to control society in order to see that through. What we saw on January 6th was an attempt by a diverse array of organizations and leaders in an attempt to pursue their goals. But what aligned them was the belief that in order to pursue their individual goals, they first needed to take control of government. And that is what we witnessed on Wednesday, January 6th. We can go into a little bit of details about some of the different goals of what I believe may have been some of the different goals of different tendencies within that coalition. But all of us should understand that the absolute goal was the banding together of far-right elements to overthrow the U.S. government. And they were very serious in their intent.
Please do parse out some of the fundamental players and within that coalition or unity of purpose, at least for January 6th, although they seem to have cohered before that and pronounced loudly and aggressively over social media that they had every intention of figuratively, if not literally, storming the gates of government. So help us understand who these groups are. And then if additional clarification, I had thought and would suggest that the unifying factor was indeed white supremacy, the form of control, which evolves from plantation capitalism of the populace of people of color across the board, most definitively in response to the preeminent cry, which was heard around the world, of Black Lives Matter, also the manifestations of xenophobia, et cetera, that are part of the conceptualization of white supremacy. So I know that's a lot to put on your plate, but take the ball.
Oh, it is a moment that calls for the willingness of those of us who believe in equity, who believe in human rights, who believe in the idea that everyone has the right to live, love, worship, work free from fear and bigotry, to dive into these complexities and to understand them. So I think it's a great question. is what we have to understand is that white supremacy, a historic and present-day system of exploitation that was grounded upon three pillars. The first was the genocide of Native people and the theft of their lands and resources. The second pillar was the exploited labor of Black people through over 500 years of chattel slavery. The third is the control of women and sexuality. Those were the three grounding pillars that allowed white supremacy to become the socializing force of our society. It was the rule of law. And I say was because in 1960s, a movement arose on the American terrain known as the 1960 Civil Rights Movement that contested white supremacy as the rule of law. And I would argue actually defeated white supremacy. Now, I'm not saying white supremacy still doesn't exist. And I'm not saying that it doesn't impact our lives. Certainly as an African American, I'm very clear about how white supremacy impacts my life each and every day. What I'm saying is that white supremacy moved from being uncontested to being placed on contested terrain. And ever since, social movements in the United States grounded around equality and opportunity have continued to chip away significantly at the vestiges and the impact of white supremacy. How do we know this? Because these largely led Black social movements have ensured that the life I live in 2021 may be difficult, may be filled with anti-Blackness, but it is not what my parents experienced in 1920s, and it is not what their great-grandparents experienced in 1820. So we have to understand that social movements that are driven by Black community have contested white supremacy in very successful ways. Now, we have this 1960s civil rights movement, and it's actually successful at contesting white supremacy. Now, imagine for a second you're an arch segregationist. You believe in Jim Crow. You believe, as you have been socialized for generations, that Black people and other people of color, women, religious minorities such as Jews and Muslims are inferior simply based off of their belief systems, their perhaps biological makeup, right, or the color of their skin. How do you all of a sudden come to terms with the fact that you've lost to people you see as inferior in every way? It's simply impossible. In 1968, arch segregationists simply weren't going to wake up and say, well, I guess I'm wrong. Black people must not be inferior after all. They needed to come up with an answer. And it is in that answer that white nationalism takes shape in the United States. What happens is if white supremacy is written upon the paper of race in America, white nationalism became written on the paper of anti-Semitism. What I mean by this, the inability of these segregationists, these white supremacists, to believe that Black people had agency and could build collective power to bring America into a real democracy meant that they had to find someone else to blame. And borrowing from anti-Semitic tracts like the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, a fake anti-Semitic narrative that was rampant in Europe, they constructed a new narrative that they didn't lose to Black people, that they lost to a global Jewish conspiracy that sought to destroy the white race. It is that first conspiracy theory that distinguishes white nationalism from the system of white supremacy. Those of us who care about real democracy, inclusive democracy, people-centered, transparent, and accountable government have to contend with the fact that we are dealing both with a system of disparity called white supremacy and a social movement called white nationalism. And white nationalism is not committed to the program of white supremacy. It is not seeking to exploit people of color, but to remove them altogether. And one way that that has shown up has been within the immigration debates in this country. If we have noticed, as this white nationalist social movement continues to gain power and emerge into the mainstream, conversation on immigration has evolved from debates around how much we are willing to exploit immigrants, right, to how much we are willing to criminalize immigrants in this country. That is white supremacy transitioning into white nationalism to a place where today many of us can still sleep comfortably at night despite the fact that immigrant children are being held in cages within our country. That is the power of white nationalism, and it is distinguished from white supremacy. But we conflate white nationalism and white supremacy each and every day. You cannot conflate them because the tools and the tactics required to respond to each phenomenon are different. And if we try to conflate them, we undercut our own ability to address both of these phenomena.
I continue to think in my own mind about Wilhelm Reich's The Mass Psychology of Fascism. The issue of what drives white people overarchingly to these extremist philosophies, whether it's to the militia-type organizations or whether it's the Boogaloo Boys or the Proud Boys or the QAnon theories, which are reminiscent of things like the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, which you referenced. It would still seem to me that the mechanism for this mass psychology of fascism taking root is indeed white supremacy, and I think back on the brilliance of W.E.B. Du Bois when he was talking about how, in what would seem to be antithetical to their interests, white people still long to be overseers. What makes this vicious, murderous philosophy of destroying the other take hold in the populace? And so, again, the glue there seemed to be that conceptualization of white supremacy, that people can advance on that, because certainly nothing is being offered to these people materially that would cause them to adhere to this philosophy, to digest it, even though they may have some perception they're losing some element of their privilege. So maybe you can flesh that out for us a bit more.
It's important, I think, to realize that this is not a phenomena that appeared last Wednesday in January 6th in Washington, D.C. Certainly, white nationalism has its origins in white supremacy. But I think we do ourselves a mistake. We become the conservative force, right? We as progressives or those on the left, liberals, we become the conservatizing force if we refuse to recognize that other social movements, other ideologies also evolve and shape. When we talk about the American racial justice movement or the American left today, we are not talking about the same movement that existed in the 1920s or in the 1890s, right, to use an example. Neither should we treat social movements or systemic phenomena that we may oppose as static items. I think one of the ways that I try to think about this is in this way, that these are not extremist movements. We need to drop the term extremist, but these are movements that I believe are tendencies that exist in American society that are tapped into in order to build political power. What is an example of that? I'll think back to September 11th and the September 11th attacks on the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and the third plane that went down in Pennsylvania. Immediately after those attacks, I was living at the time in Seattle, Washington, working for a human rights group. When I learned about the attacks, by the time I got to my office, I had already received two reports. The first is a banner that was hung over a freeway in Seattle that said death to the Palestinians. The second report that I received was that someone had shoved a stick of dynamite under the gas line of a Jewish house of worship in the sister city of Tacoma, Washington, and had written death to the Zionists. I believe, something like that. These were the first two reported responses to 9/11. Well, we know over the subsequent days, there were dozens, if not hundreds, of hate crimes targeting people who were perceived to be Muslim, Arab, and South Asian, including Latinos, including Sikhs. Over that weekend, at least two Sikh Americans, but I believe three Sikh Americans, had been murdered. Now, we have to ask the question, as we saw these hate crimes rise, was it the attacks of September 11th that unleashed this anti-Muslim hate spree and other forms of hate crimes? Or was it that the American public simply felt that it now had permission to act out on the bigotry that it already held? Well, I think there's an answer to that. As we watched these hate crimes continue to grow around the country and in our region, there was a point where it nearly just dropped off. It just suddenly stopped. And that moment seemed to correlate around when, at the time, President Bush and John Ashcroft, who was the attorney general, took to the airwaves and said, hate crimes will not be tolerated against Muslims in the United States. As soon as that was said publicly, there was significant decline in the number of hate acts being reported. In the same way, I share that story because what I believe in this moment isn't that white supremacy is dying or white nationalism is somehow on the rise. What I believe in this moment is that the events that occurred in D.C. were not simply because of the actions of the white nationalist movement and the larger alt-right coalition that it's formed. The events were allowed to take place because for 4 years, for 10 years, for 30 years, elected officials, our democratic institutions, and our human rights and progressive social movements in this country have failed to take the white nationalist movement seriously. We refuse in our own arrogance to concede that social movements are not all built on inclusion and that our social movements are not the only ones who can have influence in our society. The failure Wednesday, January 6th, was not just the federal government, but our own social movement and our own commitment to real leadership and governance in this country.
Could you go back and parse out for us who some of the leadership groups are? Who are they? They need to be named. And also within that is their relevance, influence in government itself at this point. They are being fed and funded and nurtured by certainly considerable elements within the Republican Party. Who are these groups? Sure, who helped them reach some level of unity from what were disparate and antagonistic tendencies? And then who is encouraging, utilizing their philosophy to generate political power for themselves?
Where I would take us back to understand that story, and I know I keep using long historical arcs, but I'm using them because I think it's really important. we saw taking place in Washington, D.C., actually begins in August of 1992. Some folks would take it back even further. But in 1992, there is an individual by the name of Randy Weaver in northern Idaho. He was scheduled to go on trial for selling sawed-off shotguns to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. He sold it to an informant. He defied the U.S. government's attempts to arrest him and held up in a cabin where he stockpiled with weapons and food. Law enforcement, after a shooting where one of the marshals was wounded, it ended up with Randy Weaver's wife and young son being killed in the subsequent firefight and siege. This was shocking to the far right. Now, for many Black Americans and Latinos and Native Americans, having draconian law enforcement use brutal violence and refuse to de-escalate wasn't new. But for the white supremacist, white nationalists, this was something new to them. Many of them were outraged by the botched surveillance operation. It created a true cross-section of rage. Many of these individuals, led by hardcore white nationalists, such as Pete Peters and Red Beckman, who was a Christian identity minister, he believed that Jews were the literal children of Satan, people of color were subhuman, organized an event at Estes Parks, Colorado in 1992. This was one of the first true gatherings of a cross-section of the American far right, and it occurred in the Rocky Mountains. It led to the creation of the militia movement, a fusion of gun rights advocates, Second Amendment advocates, the religious right, and white nationalists into a coalition to overthrow the U.S. government. As one speaker said in the meeting at Estes Park, we need to build a broad coalition that could even include progressives. It said we needed to build a broad-based coalition that was perhaps even multicultural. That at the end of the day, the speaker went on, and I paraphrase, first we take on the federal government, then we take on the question of the Jews. This was in 1992. Here in 2021, we saw the culmination of that organizing because it had not been disrupted, not by government, not by community leaders, not by social movement. And the movement that met in 1992 has formed and morphed and evolved ever since. So what we saw on the streets of D.C. as part of this insurrection was a large array of organizations and ideologies that have joined under the banner of Trumpism. Who were some of these? Well, they included the Proud Boys and a organization that describes itself as Western Chauvinist. This is an unarmed paramilitary formation that has been engaging in street battles and attacks on Black Lives Matter protesters and others for nearly 5 years. It is the Proud Boys who were most visible in their call for a rally, in their use of political violence, but they were not the only ones. Other individuals belonging to organizations like the Three Percenters, an armed paramilitary organization that believes that it only takes 3% of the American public to overthrow the United States, had gathered. There were members of an organization called Oath Keepers that is made up of former military and law enforcement officers who participate in. There were small grassroots organizations such as Veterans for Trump out of Southern California who joined. There were the Boogaloo Boys, a chaotic, nihilistic far-right paramilitary formation that is made up of a loose network that has been responsible for the killing of at least two law enforcement officers previous to the attack on D.C. Just to say there was an array of organizations, but I also believe there was an array of interests that were on the streets. Certain significant money was raised to help individuals get to D.C. How significant is that fundraising? We think it's very significant. Enrique Tarrio, one of the head of the Proud Boys nationally, was arrested entering D.C. 2 days before the protest. He was arrested because in a previous protest, he had attacked a historic black church, ripping down a Black Lives Matter banner and setting it on fire, and then admitted to doing so on social media. He was arrested at the airport, and when they arrested him, they also confiscated two high-capacity clips for weapons. These two high-capacity clips meant, right, that the individual could load significantly more rounds of ammunition into these clips. He was banned from D.C., but after he was arrested, within 72 hours, he had raised in excess of $80,000 in contributions. This is to say that this social movement, in many ways, functions just like other social movements. There are donors, there are foundations, there are individual contributors. It is a grassroots movement as well as a grasstops movement. Everyone should understand, it wasn't just the individuals who breached the joint session of Congress. It is the individual law enforcement officers who allowed it to happen. And I believe in some cases willfully allowed it to happen, putting even their law enforcement colleagues in risk. We know that one individual law enforcement officer was killed, crushed by a door and crushed over the head with a fire extinguisher because other law enforcement officers chose to side with the insurrection that day. We know that individuals like Rudy Giuliani actually said in a speech that day that the election should be decided as if it were trial by combat. Donald Trump himself on that day announced to the crowd that he would lead a march on Congress. We should understand that at the end of the day, the social movement that is known as the alt-right, that is driven by white nationalism, is as diverse as any other social movement in the United States. And if we want to know how it functions, we merely need to look at how our own social movements function. The difference is our social movements are grounded in inclusion. Our movements for civil rights, whether we are talking about Black Lives Matters, right, whether we are talking about the women's rights movement, whether we are talking about labor, whether we are talking about the original 1960s civil rights movement, has delivered more for white America than white nationalism and white supremacy has ever delivered for white America. Nevertheless, lasting socialization of white supremacy, the unwillingness of elected officials to stand up against white nationalists, and the unwillingness of our own social movements to take other social movements seriously that are grounded in exclusion, led to the events of a growing, powerful social movement that nearly overthrew our Congress. We should be clear that there were individuals in that grouping who were set to do harm. They had zip ties. They had already physically hurt and damaged gave injuries to a law enforcement officer that led to his death. It appears that some of these individuals knew exactly the offices they were targeting and how to find them. I have been in those spaces. I can tell you as an individual that offices are not easy to find and to navigate in those spaces without knowing where you're going. And so we should understand that this wasn't just a failure of misunderstanding the threat. There was a willfulness among some actors within the federal government, elected, right, and civil servants, who allowed these events to take place. And it is important that they're held accountable in ways that reinforce the rule of law and don't undermine our constitutional rights.
You're listening to Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg, and we're speaking with Eric Ward, Executive Director of Western States Center, a national hub for innovative responses to white nationalism and structural inequality. You certainly mentioned Giuliani. We've mentioned, or a cursory way, the president, who has been both sparking and nurturing these movements for the last 4 years as a reliable base of support. But what I'm wondering is, how do you look at the Republican Party as a whole, and then particularly some of its more members who have risen to the forefront in this, such as Hawley and Cruz? And of course, now we have QAnon members who are actually in the seat of government, who have been elected. So the role of the Republican Party in egging on, helping to consolidate in some ways and give real voice and expression to this grouping of the alt-right.
There were a number of elected officials who created space for this. I want to distinguish that between those who created space and those who specifically kind of egged on or participated in the insurrection through their presence. There were a half a dozen, minimally, state lawmakers who were involved in this insurrection. It wasn't just in D.C. Here in Portland, Oregon, where Western State Center is based, right? A state representative was involved, right, in facilitating a breach of the state capitol. Here in our own state of Oregon, I just learned yesterday that two Seattle police officers have been placed on administrative leave, right, for participating in the insurrection. Reports are beginning to surface all around the country of elected officials and civil servants who participated in this. And I think it's important that their names continue to be listed, right? Once it can be proven and established, I think, right, through legal procedure, that indeed it is true that these individuals were involved and participated. Do I believe folks should be held accountable? Absolutely.
Should we call this fascism? Is that what the Ted Cruz's, is that what the Rudy Giuliani's, is that what the Donald Trump's have now philosophically and actually taken on? Are the forces in government who are facilitating and supporting these disparate groups, it would seem, but have come together for some purpose, your senses as white nationalists, is this fascism? Should we call it that? Do we need to call it that and understand that what Hawley, what Cruz, what Trump, and various other elements of government, including many of the people that were in Trump's cabinet, whether they are in the last couple of days, possibly for career purposes, resigning or not, is this what fascism looks like?
Well, I will leave it to the academics to debate whether this is or should be called fascism or not. I have my own thought. The first being whether it is actually called fascism or not, I think has little relevance in this moment. And the reason why is we are not in Europe. So we live in a society, for the most part, where the political majority, right, historically, has never been a victim of fascism. It doesn't have an experience. The fascism is primarily a European experience. So if this were happening within Europe, it is perhaps a term that I would use because Europeans would understand what that means. Here in the United States, for, you know, 50 years now, people use fascism to mean all kinds of things. Your parents get called fascists. The media gets called fascists. The elected official you don't like, regardless of their political perspective, gets called a fascist. Fascism doesn't carry the same meaning here. And so I hesitate to use it, even if it might be the academic accurate description of what occurred. I think a more accurate term of what occurred here is that we saw an anti-democratic, small d, right? Not Democratic Party, democracy, an anti-democratic insurrection that occurred in the United States that was willing to install, right, a ideology of an authoritarianism, right, in order to undercut the U.S. Constitution and the rule of law. At the end of the day, we are dealing with an authoritarian movement, and an authoritarian movement that may be less committed, right, to its own white nationalism and more committed to political power and political rule. It's too early to say yet, but certainly authoritarian, certainly anti-democratic, and certainly seeded with racism and anti-Semitism as part of the working mechanism of how it builds its base. At the end of the day, what we should all understand is whatever we call it, that it is a serious threat. It is very clear, right, that at the end of the day, our democratic institutions, small d, seem unwilling to take this threat seriously. And it has left the American public, it has left our Constitution, and apparently even members of law enforcement, physically and politically vulnerable. And that is a disaster for 75 years of civil rights gains in this country.
In terms of not taking this threat seriously, I know that there is a planned convergence on Washington, D.C. and numerous state capitals throughout the country on the 17th. What are the plans that these groups have for those days? I haven't heard anything much about it in the media, at least, in terms of surveillance, in terms of stopping this, in terms of controlling it.
Such a good question. The truth is this is where we get into consequences and unintended consequences. We believe, yes, there have been calls for a convergence on D.C. for January 17th through January 20th. There are actual several calls that are now circulating. My sense is, I think at this point, I hope everyone understands that we need to take these movements grounded in exclusion at their word, that they seek to converge on Washington, D.C. I don't think we need to debate whether that's really going to, whether that is really their intent or not. It is. We should also not debate whether these groups are committed to violence. We now have a 5-year track record that has established that these groups are more than willing to use political violence through physical attacks, through the use of weapons and the use of explosives, right, in order to achieve their ends. It is not a debate anymore. And three, if those two things can't make our society take this moment seriously, we should understand, right, that one way of looking at what we may have observed on January 6th in Washington, D.C. was a dry run, right, to prove that, in fact, these buildings are indeed vulnerable, that law enforcement, elements of law enforcement will stand aside. And so I think we should be very clear that these threats are both imminent and they're serious. But how we respond to them is also critically important. We can't respond in panic, right? It calls for disciplined response. You cannot defend the rule of law, right, and rights in this country by undermining the rights and the rule of law of others. So it takes real intention to both de-escalate and remove the ability of these individuals to attempt to disrupt the peaceful transfer of power that is essential to any inclusive democracy and is certainly historic and traditional to how the U.S. government has governed. So I think many of these things will happen. There are many things that can be done. Why aren't we seeing a lot of chatter around plans? Well, many of these individuals have been deplatformed off of social media that most Americans use. So you're not seeing these discussions on Twitter and Facebook. There has been some law enforcement crackdown, and I want to emphasize some, because I can tell you without a doubt, if this had been done by a civil rights movement or an environmental social movement, right, and elected officials had joined into those actions and five people would have been killed in these events, I can guarantee you that there would be many more arrests that would have occurred by now. And I can tell you that there would have been many more injuries of those who engaged in those activities in D.C. We're not seeing the chatter because some of the arrests have chilled, right, the willingness of the white nationalist movement and its alt-right coalition to talk about these things openly and publicly. The third is that this growing split within the Republican Party has made it unclear, likely to elements, who they can or cannot coordinate with in this moment.
As we draw to conclusion, one of the concerns that you and I had spoken about and that I know is shared with Ken is the question of how to respond without inadvertently falling into a constriction of our own forms of protest or expression, assemblage, civil liberties. Having said that, how do we respond and what are your thoughts about a permanent banning from social media, which has, of course, been done to colleagues of mine on issues of great import. They have been censored, particularly around the issue of Palestine and the like. So how do we not fall into a trap of, in our exuberance or fear, to discipline the perpetrators of abuses to the social norm and the social process and or indeed involved in and directly relevant to people dying, how do we proceed such as not to hamper, destroy our own civil liberties?
I think this is the most important question. I think the most important piece is we have to resist being turned into reactionaries because of political terror. We have to understand that authoritarianism, right, doesn't just arise from the far right and the white nationalist movement and its alt-right forces. The idea of authoritarianism right now is mainstream, right? It is the alt-right and the white nationalist movement tapping into something that is in the air we breathe right now. We are not alone in that in the United States. Authoritarianism has anchored itself as a theory of change. And all of us who can who care about rights, who care about equality, have to understand, right, that we have to shield and inoculate ourselves from those authoritarian tendencies. The way to do that in this moment, I say this as someone who has been involved in organizing against the white nationalist movement, helping communities respond for over three decades, is this. We first have to understand that our goal is not the destruction of the white nationalist movement. Our goal is to ensure that we have inclusive democracy in America, people-centered, transparent, and accountable governance. That is the best defense against white nationalist tendencies. The second is we have to understand the rule of unintended consequences, that the things that we do out of fear and concern can have larger, right, repercussions on rights in our own social movement. So we have to be careful that we are really adhering, right, to the rule of law, right, to value, and understanding that our values, in fact, in this moment are more important than our ideologies, right, which are merely vehicles for us to express our values. And what I mean by that is when we call for the use of the 25th Amendment, when we call for impeachment, I'm not saying we shouldn't do so, and I'm not saying that I don't support those calls. What I'm saying is, we should at least consider why are elements on the right calling for those same things. And in this case, I would tell people to think about the historic moment about the overthrow of the Shah in Iran, where the fundamentalist religious right in Iran joined forces with the political left in Iran to oppose the Shah, right? The Shah was a brutal dictator. Right? Removing the Shah from power makes sense. But we have to ask ourselves, where is the left in Iran today and what happened? And we have to be careful as we move forward around making sure we don't undermine our own democratic infrastructure, small d, in this society, democratic infrastructure that it has taken 75 years to build. As John Lewis said, right, that we have moved, right, from the idea of democracy as an aspiration to democracy being real. And that is because of over 75 years of civil rights struggle. Civil liberties cannot just be tossed to the side because they are inconvenient. One of the unintended consequences, and I'm a person who believes, right, that some of these individuals should be removed from Twitter and Facebook, but one of the unintended consequences is by removing, we have actually helped them and forced them to build their own alternative platforms. They may not be as vibrant as a Facebook or a Twitter, but it still allows them to communicate in a way now that makes it hard for us to monitor and to understand and interject in. We just have to be careful in this moment and understand that for every action, there is a reaction, and we need to understand what those reactions are.
Eric, I just want to ask if you want to punctuate our discussion with a final kind of summary.
One final thought that I'll leave folks with. It has been a really difficult 4 years. My father, who is in his 90s today, though, would tell me, Eric, it has been a long 90 years as a black man in America. So I urge us to hold things in perspective. But I do want to acknowledge it's been a hard year. We've had to deal with the specter of a global pandemic that has now taken over nearly 380,000 American lives, is likely to take probably somewhere around 500,000. Right before we get this under control due to the failures of the present administration. We have record unemployment. Our economy is in shambles when it comes to income equality in our society. We have been dealing with political violence over the last year that has taken the lives of racial justice protesters, law enforcement and including individuals in the far right. It has been a burdensome year, and it's easy to want to try to retreat or to believe this idea that there is a civil war or a race war brewing in America. That is white nationalist propaganda. The truth is that our movements for justice and equity are winning. And what we are seeing, right, is a reactionary insurrection. It is a reaction to the fact that social equity in America, economic justice in America, is actually winning, right? It is actually capturing the imagination of Americans across lines of race, religion, gender, sexual orientation, ethnicity. In fact, today in the United States, more white people are supportive of Black Lives Matter by percentage, right, than were ever supportive of Martin Luther King Jr. in his entire life. The arc bends towards justice, and we should not buy into the white nationalist defeatism narrative that they are attempting to get us to drink. I will also say this. We have to endure. We have to use our voices in this moment. You have to be an organization. I don't care if that's a quilting organization, right? I don't care if that's the Working Families Party, Southern Poverty Law Center, Western State Center, a host of organizations. You cannot face this moment alone, either through your house of worship or through another association. You have to begin to talk to other folks around what you will do if there is a real attempted coup in the United States. How will you respond? Spend your time thinking about that over the last 2 weeks. Do one thing. I'm not asking people to take on everything. What we're asking Americans to do is to defend democracy. And you defend democracy by choosing to do one thing. Figure out that one thing. Make it count. When I was a kid, I used to play a game called If I Were. And If I Were was like, if I found myself in the zoo and the lion got out, here's what I would do. And we'd argue about with kids about with each other about what we would or wouldn't do. The question that always came up was, if I were in the midst of the 1960s civil rights movement, here is what I would do. And as kids, we would argue. We were full of bravado about what we would do and what we wouldn't do, what we would put up with, what we wouldn't put up with. We didn't understand the choiceless choices of our parents who were living under white supremacy as the rule of law. We were full of ourselves. That question has always haunted me. What would I do? And that question might be haunting those who are listening right now. What would you do in the midst of the 1960s civil rights movement? Well, I'll leave you with this. None of us have to wonder that question anymore. We are in a moment where whatever it is we would have done in the midst of the 1960s civil rights movement is exactly what you are going to do when this conversation ends. Make it count. Defend democracy, the value, right, of unity, de-escalation, and building the power of the most vulnerable, trusting that the most vulnerable in our communities across the United States lift all of us forward together. Make it count. History will judge us. Our children will ask us what we did in this moment.
Eric Ward, Executive Director and Senior Fellow with the Southern Poverty Law Center and Race Forward, and Executive Director of Western State Center, a national hub of innovative responses to white nationalism and structural inequality. Thank you for joining us. To all our listeners, stay strong, stay well, educate, agitate, and organize to empower we the people, for a better world is possible, and we are the ones to make it so.
WBAI's local station board is the Pacifica Foundation board responsible for advising management and operations. The next meeting of the local station board will be Wednesday, January 13th at 7 p.m. Because of coronavirus precautions and restrictions, the meeting will be a remote access meeting, which will be accessible to the public. It will include an opportunity for the public to comment. This January meeting will also be a delegates assembly to consider WBAI's representatives on the Pacifica National Board this year. Again, that's Wednesday, January 13th at 7 p.m. The meeting held through the Zoom remote meeting service can be accessed by calling in the U.S. 929-205-6099 and entering the meeting ID 922-457-2995. Again, that telephone number to call is 929-205-6099 and the meeting ID is 922-457-2995. A link to the instructions, including listening over the web and how to submit written comments, will be available through WBAI's main webpage. If you miss an LSB meeting, you can listen afterwards through the Pacifica posting. Do you have to contribute?